U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The United States negotiates a supposed five-day ceasefire with Turkey in its campaign against the Kurds in northern Syria. But will it hold? Shelling has already resumed. And what comes next? Plus, what we learned this week about the investigation into impeaching Donald Trump. Welcome, I'm Paul Gigot with the Wall Street Journal, and here to talk about these pressing concerns is my colleague Kyle Peterson. Hey, Kyle.
Hello, hello.
So let's start with the Syria. I think it's fair to say, well, we called it in the paper a fiasco. Vice President Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo were dispatched to Ankara to try to negotiate what they called a ceasefire. I guess I would call it something less than that in practice. They did manage to get this suspension, supposedly, of hostilities for 5 days in northern Syria, a suspension essentially in the Turkish invasion of northern Syria to drive the Kurds out of the safe zones that they had been occupying with American special forces until 2 weeks ago when President Trump withdrew those American special forces and essentially acquiesced in President Erdogan of Turkey's desire to oust the Kurds. The Turks claim that they got everything they wanted in terms of a buffer zone, and they'll have to expend less military force to oust the Kurds if, in fact, the Kurds do leave. But now we see that a day after the ceasefire is announced, there's still shelling going on, still fighting. So we really don't know if this will hold, Kyle.
Right. And there are just a lot of different interests at work. You have Turkey in there now. You have the Kurds who have their own interests. You have Assad. You have Russia. And it seems like a very unstable situation and one that is not going to get back to equilibrium very quickly, which, again, is the problem with this destabilizing policy of just immediately withdrawing U.S. troops without any thought or plan for what would come after. After that, but Trump, as usual, is selling this ceasefire deal as the greatest deal that's ever been made. He's talking about, you know, quote, "I just want to thank and congratulate President Erdogan. He's a friend of mine. Frankly, he's a hell of a leader and he's a tough man."
A tough man, and I just reminded of the scene in Pretty Woman where the Richard Gere, you know, says to the attendant at the store, "You have to with some sucking up you're needed." He goes, "Oh, you're not only a powerful man, you're a handsome man," and there's just that effusive praise of the president he does for Erdogan, which is so over the top.
Is strange to me and a little unbecoming an American president, I think, if I can let my small R republicanism show a little bit. But the question, I think, is what is going to happen next, how bad it's going to get. I mean, there's reports that Kurds are accusing Turkish forces or proxies of deploying white phosphorus, an incendiary, and burning some people who showed up in the hospitals. Apparently, the UN is now going to start looking into that. It's just the question is what comes next and how bad it will be.
Well, the president also sent a letter to Erdogan, which was in, how should we say, undiplomatic style, saying, "Don't be a fool, stop this." And Erdogan, according to Turkish news sources, threw it into a wastebasket. And Erdogan has since said publicly this letter now made it into the public. So we won't forget this insult. The interesting thing also, so we don't know what's going to happen in Congress on the ground, although it's likely that Turkey will get what it wants in the north. The Kurds will strike a deal with Assad of some kind for self-preservation. The Russians will fill the vacuum in that part that the Turks don't. And the Iranians will, with as much as they're able, continue to develop the southern part of Syria on the border with their proxy forces and military to prepare for what I assume will eventually be a war with Israel.
Yeah, and all of that helps explain why, you know, Republicans in Congress were so emboldened that 129 of them voted for this resolution condemning the withdrawal.
In the House.
In the House, right. That is a pretty serious rebellion from Republican discipline. President Trump is notorious for coming down like a ton of bricks on people who buck his line, and people, you know, politicians in the House, other Republicans live in fear of the presidential tweet, but apparently not so much any longer.
Well, the on that point, the three the main leaders of the Republicans in the House, the minority leader, Kevin McCarthy, Steve Scalise, the whip, and Liz Cheney, the head of the conference, all of them voted with the Democrats to condemn the president's withdrawal, criticize the president's withdrawal. I don't think it used the word condemn, but it heavily criticized it. And also, so did nearly all of the main national security experts in the House. I'm thinking of Mac Thornberry, former head chair of the Armed Services Committee, Michael Gallagher, a up-and-coming Marine veteran from Wisconsin, plays a lot in foreign affairs. They all voted against it. The final vote was 350 in favor of the resolution, rather. The final vote was 354 to 60. And the question is, how much of that would carry over into the Senate if there were a comparable vote? Mitch McConnell he opposed going with that the same resolution this week, saying, though, you know, I think it should be even stronger.
Right. And Lindsey Graham, who is a Trump ally in most other respects, is reportedly working on a bill that would tighten some sanctions on Turkey. Part of this ceasefire deal is reportedly that if it holds, you know, the U.S. sanctions on Turkey will rise and be lifted. And meanwhile, this has contributed to the breakdown on Capitol Hill between Trump and the Democrats, the fighting in that closed meeting between Nancy Pelosi and Trump. There's a picture of her that has been circulating of her pointing a finger toward him. You know, that doesn't help the president either, because he still wants to get his USMCA trade deal through the House, which he says is going to be the greatest deal ever to replace NAFTA.
I can tell you, it's not just reportedly that Lindsey Graham's doing this. I talked to the Senator Graham this week. He has put together a draft sanctions bill, and he's got co-sponsors, Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, Senator Blumenthal of Connecticut, and others on both sides of the aisle. And this would be really very, very serious sanctions. I mean, it's targeted directly at Erdogan of Turkey and his main advisors, main officials. It would bar them from travel from the U.S. It would focus on looking at their assets, financial assets overseas. It would presumably freeze whatever assets they had. It has sanctions against Turkish energy and finance. And it even says about President Erdogan that it would require a report from the U.S. government about Erdogan's assets and financial holdings, which is a direct assault on Erdogan's credibility and reputation. And Graham says, told me that, look, they've got 5 days here, and if this doesn't hold, this suspension of hostilities, or if there's no progress made, as is supposed to be continuing negotiations while this so-called ceasefire is in place for 5 days, if there's no progress made on towards a solution that gets the Turks and that satisfies the Turks' security interests and finds a place for the Kurds, then Graham is going to push for this, he said, in the Senate as early as next week and see if he can get a vote on it. Now, there's undoubtedly going to be some negotiations here, but he thinks you could get 80 votes in the Senate.
And if you got 80 votes in the Senate, you know, I assume that that would fly through the Democratic House, too, which would be a pretty serious rebuke of the president's policy here. Would it be vetoable?
Well, it certainly would be vetoable. But as you say, 80 votes, if it got that many, you know, only need 67 to override a veto in the Senate. You need something in the order of 290, some, I think, to override a veto in the House. There's 354. Now, the president would push hard on this. Push back, and there may be Republicans who fall away in either the House or the Senate. But it would still, even if it, no matter what the effort was, it would embarrass the president. And I think that there's an erosion. The larger danger here is there's an erosion of confidence, even among the Republican Party, in the president's decision making and judgment on foreign policy. And I think that's reflected in the effort you see on Capitol Hill.
Right. And that's the, I mean, the backdrop to all of this, everything that goes on in Washington is the impeachment inquiry that the House is undertaking. And so the question in the back of everybody's minds is if there is a good chunk of the Republicans in the House that are willing to buck the president on this, is there a good chunk of them, some of them that would vote for an impeachment or for a conviction in the Senate?
Well, we will get to that after the break. We're talking about Syria and impeachment, and you're listening to the Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with the Wall Street Journal with my esteemed colleague, Kyle Peterson. Let's talk about the issue you raised before the break, impeachment, and the ongoing investigation in the House of Representatives and the Intelligence Committee continuing in secret, not subject to public scrutiny. The interviews going on, testimony from various officials that they're collecting on the Ukraine incident, going back to the president's call with the president of Ukraine on July 25, and whether or not the president sought to coerce the Ukrainian president to investigate corruption and including Joe Biden and his son's Hunter's activities in Ukraine. You know, the parade, Kyle, of officials and former officials of the State Department and the National Security Council, including Fiona Hill, former NSC aide under John Bolton, Gordon Sondland, the European Union ambassador, who said that in his opening statement that he had in fact advised the president, he criticized the president for essentially trying to use the depress Ukrainians on going back to investigate in 2016. But the problem we have here overall is we don't know what they really said under questioning. We really don't know the context for what they said other than the opening statements. So we're relying on press reports, which may or may not be accurate and which almost certainly reflect the larger purposes of either the Democrats or the Republicans here.
And that's not been the tradition when an impeachment investigation is underway. So Nancy Pelosi has said that she's not going to hold a vote to officially move forward with an impeachment investigation. So her statement at a press conference saying that we're doing an impeachment inquiry, that's the official opening of an impeachment inquiry. And what is a little bit odd about it to me is if you were in Nancy Pelosi's shoes, that you'd think that you would want to present this to the public as a neutral investigation. You'd want to follow all previous precedents. You would want to do exactly what they did in the Nixon case and in the Clinton case, which was to you know, have a vote to open impeachment and then you know, provide some procedural safeguards to the other side. Give the chairmen's the with the minority party, whether it's Republicans or Democrats, but in this case, case, the Republicans, some subpoena power to, you know, call witnesses of their own. And they haven't done that. So, I mean, maybe they plan to rectify that later on. And some of the witnesses that are being heard in private now, they intend to recall them and re-interview them before the C-SPAN cameras. Or maybe they intend to just do it this way and
drive to impeachment with this way. I don't think they can get away with that.
You don't think they can?
Well, I think they're going to have a very hard time. I mean, I suppose that they could. Well, they could. They can construct impeachment any way they want. That's the constitutional point. Donald Trump calls them. They said the process is unconstitutional. It's not. House under the Constitution can do essentially what it wants on impeachment. It can define high crimes and misdemeanors however it wants. The point, though, is that this is fundamentally a political process. And if you want to succeed as a matter of politics, you have to persuade a good chunk of the public. And presumably, you want to be seen as operating in reasonable good faith. And giving the and that includes giving the defenders of the president, whether it's his lawyers or Republicans on Capitol Hill, the chance to cross-examine witnesses to public effect, the chance for the public to be able to see what those witnesses say and how credible they are, not just go in secret behind, take a bunch of testimony, pull out a couple of facts, and then put them together in articles of impeachment and vote on them on a partisan vote, and then throw them over to the Senate and say, "Oh, you can have the trial, sir." That's going to fail as a political exercise because I think it looks like it's not in good faith.
Yeah, and I agree that, I mean, I hope that that's what they do if they continue to move forward with this. I guess two things that would perhaps
you mean
in
you
the
hope they
direction.
Have some public hearings?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and do it
more
in
transparent.
Open.
Yeah,
two points that would point in the opposite direction. Perhaps is there's been a lot of seizing on Trump's public comments. You know, when he said excuse me, China, you know, should open an investigation into the Bidens in public. You know, there have been a lot of seizing on that as, you know, this is self impeaching essentially, and then. Number two is they do seem to be winning the PR battle at this point. I mean, there's a Pew Research Survey poll that is new in the last few days. 54% support an impeachment inquiry, 44% oppose. They've been moving those numbers in the direction that they want to for weeks, and it's been slow. But they have not suffered in the polling for doing this all in private.
Well, but it changes. I mean, I grant you that, and that's no doubt reassuring to Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats. On the other hand, what they ultimately will have to do is go to a vote. And how well have they? It's one thing to have 54% for an inquiry. It's what happens when you get to the articles of impeachment and what's the evidence in the case that you have built over time, rather than an assertion that, well, Trump had this conversation with so on and you know, three or four other bits of evidence that the people haven't had a chance to really inspect or submit to any kind of a contrary interpretation. But I agree with you. It is moving. It's moving fast. They could spring this quickly. The other event that happened this week, Mick Mulvaney, the acting chief of staff of the president, had a press availability in which he said things that were interpreted by the press as saying, look, the president did withhold aid to Ukraine because he wanted action on corruption, including the 2016 activities of Ukrainians to influence the 2016 American election. And the press interpreted that to say, aha, quid pro quo, that the White House had been denying. Then Mulvaney came out later that same day and said, oh, come on, there's no quid pro quo here at all. That's not what I said. I do think that his statement overall, his appearances, was a mistake because it confused everybody. It did seem to make some concessions that the White House hadn't had before. If they're true, he should make them. And they should stick to a story, should find a defense. I think this suggests to me, Kyle, that the White House just has not found a consistent line. I think they're disorganized And there's no real defense other than ad hocery that I can see.
I agree on both points. I mean, so the Mulvaney line in his original press conference was talking about, you know, did the president mention to me in the past the corruption related to the DNC server, the Democratic National Committee server? Absolutely no question about that. But that's why we held up the money, was what he seemed to be saying. So what he seemed to be saying was that there was a direct tie between the foreign aid that had been put on hold and requests that the Ukrainians investigate 2016 meddling. What makes that a little bit dangerous is that in a lot of cases, the investigation into 2016 meddling and the investigation into the Bidens are put in the same breath. So in the opening statement that you referenced earlier by the U.S. ambassador to the EU, he said that Trump told him to speak to Rudy Giuliani, and Giuliani told him that the president wanted an investigation into those two things, into the 2016 meddling and into Burisma, which is the Ukrainian company that Hunter Biden was on the board for. So, I mean, I agree. It looked to me like a significant concession or admission. And then when he, you know, even if you credit it, when he goes back and says, that's not what I was trying to say, there was no quid pro quo, it just adds to the public perception and creates a problem for the White House.
Yeah, I still don't see here that this rises, in my own view, to the level of an impeachable offense. But it does. I think the White House doesn't quite appreciate the degree of trouble it's in here, and the fact that this is a direct danger if it can't be controlled to ultimately what could happen in the Senate. The other thing that I think we learned this week in more detail, we knew that Rudy Giuliani was essentially a kind of private envoy of the president to Ukraine to get them lobby the Ukrainians to investigate Biden and corruption. And that is was deeply disconcerting, we are learning, to officials in the administration. Fiona Hill at the NSC said that John Bolton had opposed it. She felt very uncomfortable with it. Other people in the State Department felt uncomfortable with it. We know that the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine was sacked because she apparently was not as vociferous enough in pushing Ukraine in this area. This is just a bad look. I don't know that it's we will have to see if the evidence rises to an impeachable offense, but it demonstrates, to my mind, bad judgment and shows how the president here is preoccupied with digging into 2016 and what happened. And I would have thought he should have given that up.
Right. One of the things that the U.S. ambassador to the EU said was that, you know, the people in the State Department who were over there thought it would be a good idea, you know, to get President Trump and the new Ukrainian president together. And the only way they felt like they could do that was to go through Giuliani. And you should not have the president's private lawyer, you know, freelancing like that. The other thing that I think is interesting, just in terms of the White House seeming to not know how to play defense on this, is Mick Mulvaney, you know, came out in that press conference, and the reason he came out was to announce that, you know, the U.S. is going to be hosting the G7 summit next summer at President Trump's resort in Miami, which just, again, I mean, why would you do that? Why would you do that right now? Democrats are charging that the president has used his office for his public office for private gain. I don't know why they would announce that they're hosting the G7 at a Trump property right now. It makes no sense to me.
Plays into the Democratic argument that they say the president is conducting the presidency to serve his personal interests rather than the good of the country. You don't want to play into that
right,
if you're the president.
Just giving the Democrats another stick to beat you with.
So just to finish, final point, Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader, has told his Republican colleagues to start to get ready for a Senate trial on impeachment, the implication being that the House could act to impeach the president and could do so as early as Thanksgiving, before Thanksgiving. So they should be prepared maybe by December to have a vote on impeachment. That might be a little early, but maybe not. So the likelihood is that this is going to move to a vote of impeachment in the House, and the Senate will conduct a trial if that happens, according to Mitch McConnell. All right. Thank you, Kyle. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week with more editions of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.